So welcome to the fourth of our online presentations at BIPS. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Andrew Newman from Edinburgh University. As you can see, it's the land of perpetual sunset up there. And apart from that, Andrew has been at Edinburgh since about 1996. He has a personal chair in Islamic studies and Persian. And after doing his BA at Dartmouth College, he did his MA and PhD at University of California in Los Angeles. And then he's worked at the Wellcome Institute on the history of medicine. He has a long CV, which I'm not going to tell you all about now. I think his main areas of research have been on the history of Islamic medicine, but also on Shi'i studies, and he's editing a journal on Shi'i studies, and he's written copiously on different aspects of it, one of which is an article that became very famous on the emigration of Jebel Armili scholars to Iran at the beginning of the Safavid period. He's now a new member of the Council of BIPS, and he had a BIPS project, which is essentially the stuff of his talk today, which was looking at subaltern history from the 13th century to the modern era. Subaltern studies, of course, being the study of layers of society below the ruling elite and the court, which are usually what one finds in the chronicles and the main sources of the period. So that's his talk today. I should just say that the talk should last about half an hour, maybe a little less, maybe a little more. And then we'll have a question and answer session. And you can write your questions in on the question and answer function. And I will do my best to moderate these and either pass them over to Andrew to answer or write a polite note saying that your question will not be answered this time. So without more ado, thank you very much, and over to Andrew.
Thank you, Charles, very much. Thank you for inviting me. I've got about 15 or 16 slides, and so what I intend to do is offer some introductory remarks, talk about three articles that I've published in the last, all in the same year, two of which talk about antinomian behavior, and this is numbers 2 and 3 on your screen, and then the fourth one published in Lloyd Ridgeon's Routledge Handbook of Sufism, talks about Sufis and Sufi orders in general, and then I'll offer some summary thoughts and a conclusion. Some of you may have seen the special issue 53 of Iranian Studies published this year on endangered Iranian languages, language contact, and language islands in Iran. This reminded me, when I was living in Mashhad in 1975 and 76, of Persian those days as certainly being an important language, but not being Iran's only language. I had a very good friend who spoke Turkish, and he and I used to go around Mashhad and Khorasan and elsewhere. And actually his Turkish did him much better than my Persian in many of the circles in which we traveled at the time. Before living in Mashhad, I lived in Kermanshah for 6 months in 75. And Kurdish would have been, if I'd had it, much more useful than Persian, except in some very limited circles in Kermanshah. Now, if you look at this language map here, it's originally 1964 and it's updated for 2006, kind of illustrates my point there. You can see this map of the various languages in Iran at the time. So if this is the case, then in the 60s and 70s, and remember, Iran only became a majority urban society in the early 1980s, then what was the situation back in the Safavid period, 1500s and 1600s, or 1700s? And Floor sort of answers this question, or answered this question about 20 years ago now, that he estimated that the total population of Iran in those days, on the plateau, as I call it, was about 9 million or so, of whom 85 to 90% of the population was rural, tribal, and peasant. And he then goes on to talk in the subsequent pages, page 12 and forward, of the religious differences, the linguistic differences, the ethnic differences, meaning once again that one could possibly argue that Persian wasn't the realm's majority language, or possibly not even spoken by the plurality of the population. So Iran, actually, when I teach in my classes, I like to say it was multicultural before anybody ever thought about the term in the first place. But what it does mean, as Charles was suggesting, is that the Persian and Arabic language sources, the secular and religious texts on which academics tend to focus to find out what was going on in Iran at the time, mainly were written by some elites for other elites and maybe on the mainly on the urban side. Here I rule out the foreign travelogues, whose reliability has been the subject of some discussion, finally. And also, of course, the court chronicles have their own kinds of agendas. Admiral would be discussed by Sholeh Quinn in her book on historical writing during the age of Abbas I. So the argument is then the urban and rural illiterate, the majority anywhere in any society, left no written records, and therefore their voices are very difficult to recover. And so what I've been trying to do is try to recover those voices by a la sort of Walter Benjamin, reading against the grain. He talked about brushing against the grain, and I'm talking about reading against the grain. That is taking the text and trying to find out who the audiences were and what were the arguments that were trying to be made, and then read these back into understanding who were the protagonists here as well. So the idea then is to take the population and as I say in the title, invert the pyramid. Turn the whole thing upside down, get the bulk of the population up there, and then try and figure out avenues to understanding what it was that they thought and their beliefs and their practices. And if you do that, my argument is you find out, I think, that the interests and agendas of the majority of the population were actually very different to those of the scholarly elite. And it suggests that the spiritual discourse of the period with which we today are most familiar was actually probably in the minority. So I did this across these three papers. The first one was one done in Venice overlooking the canal, which is lovely. The second one was done, was a conference by late Leonard Lewison at Exeter. And the third of these papers that I'm going to discuss today was in Lloyd Ridgeon's Routledge Handbook of Sufism. The first of these papers looked at some treatises directed against the veneration of Abu Muslim, the Iranian, Iran-based Abbasid agent who sort of initiated the process, according to the understanding of the Abbasid rebellion and the eventual downfall of the Umayyads. There's been some discussion of these particular essays, but nobody had ever looked at them before in any detail. And so I found them and I discussed what the content was and looked at them all the way. And what you can see here is first of all, the length increases markedly from 4.5 to 8 to 27 pages. And you can also see the extant copies, which to use the vernacular, well, there weren't very many. There ain't many extant copies, one copy, four copies, and one copy, as you can see there. And what this illustrates, actually, we can unpack this for some of the ideas that were floating around in the area about the people who venerated Abu Muslim, what they thought and what they did. But you can also see that the discourse here was in the minority. That is, the attack, those who were attacking the veneration of Abu Muslim were actually in the minority. Okay, all these texts were written in Persian. They grow in length, as I said. They portray Abu Muslim as a great friend of Ahlul Bayt, the prophet, and family of the prophet, but especially in this case, the imams. They look at him as an incarnation. They attack his view of himself as being an incarnation of the divine. And there are references in these texts to songs and singing and claims to Hulul and such as well. These three texts were the only ones, and again in very few numbers, of some 24 essays that were listed attacking the veneration of Abu Muslim and defending one Mir Lauhi, who was a student, as I say, down further on of Sheikh Baha'i and Mir Damod and others, who was attacking this veneration at the time. They were written across they seem to have been directed mainly, I would suggest, at a rising millenarian tendency among the urban-based Persian-speaking population, artisans and craft population of Isfahan in particular, which population was growing commensurate with the expansion of the city, both commercially, politically, and in terms of spiritual infrastructure as well. They were written across the reigns of three Safavid rulers, and that they got longer and included more references to religious and historical texts, suggests that their authors were getting increasingly frustrated with the popularity of the Abu Muslim tradition in these years, But also it suggests that that popular veneration was in fact expanding or very, very popular. Again, as I say, it seems to have been mainly an Isfahan-based phenomenon. There's not too much reference to this in other sites on the Iranian plateau or in Iraq at the same time. Again, they portrayed Abu Muslim as a friend of the Imams, as the incarnation of the divine, lots of singing and songs going on. There are also some references to Sunnis still being on the scene, which is quite interesting. Figures whom we know, whose careers in these areas haven't really been explored, Sheikh Bahai and Mir Damad, are portrayed in these texts as actively supporting the attack on the veneration of Abu Muslim and supporting their student Mir Lauhi against what I would possess is in the majority. In fact, then I suggest the anti-Abu Muslim polemicists were in the minority and they were on the defensive. And in the mention of songs and singing and claims to Hulul and such like that, you set the stage for the later twists and turns of the anti-Sufi polemic that took place in the 1640s, 50s, and through that time. So again, the notion is that the limited legacy of the written word of the polemic suggests that on the street, as it were, Abu Muslim was a pretty popular figure, and that those figures who were attacking this and some rather venerable figures in our own understanding of the main figures, spiritual figures of the Safavid period, were in fact on the defensive throughout the period. I've written some more on these essays, these anti-Sufi essays and such, including an article published in Iran in 1999, but I'm not really going to talk about that here. I'm going to go to the next one. And that is a paper I published in the collection of the Exeter Conference, convened by the late Leonard Lewison and Reza Tabandeh, which is entitled as above. These focused on some works of Muhammad Tahir Qomi. Now, Muhammad Tahir Qomi is well known as a fierce critic of Sufism and philosophy, and he's also known as an akhbari, that is someone who opposed the use of ijtihad in jurisprudential thinking. I'm not terribly interested in the akhbari aspect, it's discussed in the paper, but here I'm going to concentrate on I'm going to concentrate on three of the four texts that I talk about in the paper. And these are their names and their dates. Hikmat al-Arafin is an anti-philosophy text written in Arabic. I'm going to kind of set that aside. And I want then briefly to look at these other three texts and what it is of beliefs and practices Qomi is denouncing. And so this is what I'm going to do very quickly. Reda Sufia, written around 1650 or so, is in two parts. I've written an article a long time ago on part one, and main part of this paper in this volume talks about part two. But if we look at both parts together, you can see the sorts of things that Qomi is denouncing. And he's denouncing things like wine, intoxication. I'm not going to read all of these, but hand clapping, a lot of physical activity, don't like meat, free love, not attending the mosque, too much time praying in the Khanaqah. Wearing ragged clothes, saying that everything that is haram is in fact okay, estrangement from the ulama, not paying much attention to the ulama, denounces their belief in Vahdat of Wujud, a doctrine which Qomi says Halaj's followers took from Christians. And Qomi is careful to note in a couple of references too that a lot of these individuals against whom he's writing have associations with present day Bazaris. Part two of the essay links these bad practices with bad people in the past, such earlier Sufi figures as Bayezid and then Halaj as well. If you move over to Tawfiq al-Akhyar, date 1656 to 1664, in it he refers to the Hikmah Arabic text, so you know at least it postdates that. Herein also, he's linking present day bad practices with past day bad people, that is people who didn't like Ahlul Bayt, didn't like the Imams, and didn't like Shiism as it was developing in those times. He's notable in this text for citing Sufi texts in order to show this. So there's lots of quotes from Ibn Arabi, Rumi, hope I've Persianized all these names, Rumi, Al-Attar, Shabastari, Jami, and such as well. It's book length. So rather like the last two anti-Abu Muslim tracts, it suggests that Qomi feels like he really needs to double down on this because his earlier efforts and the efforts of others to attack this thing and make this thing go away have not been successful. So we're really going to nail it this time with a book and lots of quotes and such. And we're going to use the texts, the Sufi texts against Sufis in order to show that this is what they really said and these practices are the practices that they really espoused and advocated. And we all know that these practices are bad. So again, across these texts, you see the following items get denounced. Some newish ones, predestination, transmigration of souls, the special clothes, monasticism, that of a Jude is there, promulgating claims to divinity or the imamate. So he says that he cites El Attar and Shabastari that Ibn Arabi did this. A lot of sitting in seclusion in hermitages, not paying the zakat, not doing the hajj, praise of prominent Sunni figures, and claiming that they could see Iblis and that Iblis was afraid of him. The text is notable for Homi's comment that the Nurbakhshiyya, who held that Muhammad Nurbakhsh was the Mahdi, was then the most popular order in Iran. Let me go to the last of Homi's texts here. This is Al-Fawa'id al-Diniyya. It postdates Tawfiq al-Akhyar because there's some references in there, and I note these in the text. So probably after 1664 or sometime. It's not been published, not paid too much attention to date. 32 manuscript folios, 37 questions and answers of varying lengths. Overall, the text is intended to deal with fatwas against philosophy, the unbelief of the believers, the followers of Bayezid and Halaj, the virtues of the religious sciences, and the fuqaha and the ulama generally, and their role in being the repositories of the religious sciences. He takes the familiar strategy across most of these of condemning present day bad beliefs and practices with past bad people, okay? And he does so once again, as he had in the Tawfa, by citing the author's works against these practices. So across these 37 Q&As, I'm only gonna focus on these ones of these kinds of behavior and doctrines as well. One of the things he's doing, as he does in the introduction, is he upholds the obligatory nature of seeking ilm and it's being centered in the imams and seeking it from the ulama. In the process then he denounces again Halaj and Bayezid for this notion of attaining unity with Allah. He cites in this a long passage from El Attar. He denounces Ibn Arabi and his followers for belief in Vahdat of Wujud, and again he recites refers to his earlier hikmah. He cites Ibn Arabi's denial in the Fusus of the reality of hell. He cites Rumi's Masnavi on the lapsing of the law, again, referring to Tufa, so this clearly postdates that. And he cites Rumi as maintaining that Ali's killer, Ibn Muljam, was an instrument of Allah. So did any of this have any impact? And how, if it did or didn't, how can we gauge that? And the answer is, in my view, it didn't have very much impact. And again, one tends to look at this in the way of seeing how many copies there were of these texts in his own lifetime, let alone the remainder of the Safavid period, or that is earlier into the 1700s. Read, for example, only two of seven extant copies date to his lifetime of the Tawfa. If you want them really firmly datable to his own lifetime, he got three. If you expand it to the end of the century, you end up with another three. So you get six out of the 17 are dated to this period. The Hikmah, which I include simply for reference points, 10 of 21 copies can be dated to the 17th century. Though that seems-ish to be 50%, so about as popular as some of the others. Al-Fawa'id, one of three copies dated to his lifetime. So the answer is that Homi's impact, if we judge it in this way, was about the same as that of the anti-Abu Muslim polemic. That is, three essays of 24 being extant, and of those three essays, they're not being very many copies. Now, lastly, then, I want to talk very, very briefly about some points I made in the article I wrote for Lloyd Ridgen's Routledge Handbook on Sufism. And here I'm looking at the some order and some non-order Sufi style activity as well, again, very briefly. And Homi's comment that the Nurbakhshis were very popular in his own time was dismissed by some other scholars. But actually, some more recent research corroborates Homi that the Nurbakhshis were quite so popular, especially in the Mashhad area and in Khorasan generally. And Homi does mention Khorasan as being a kind of hotbed of Sufi style activity elsewhere in Tufa. We know from research by Atta Ansali that the Zahabis were quite popular in Isfahan in the 1660s. The 1680s, as I say here on the PowerPoint, some socioeconomic crises led the Zahabis to decamp to Shiraz, wherein the order seems to have flourished. the Zahabi master Nairizi in 1760, died 1760, actually trained in Shiraz, then he moves back to Isfahan. And he had some post 1722, that is post Afghan invasion observations on the city, which suggests the vitality of both philosophical and popular Sufi activity. The latter, interestingly, he does in the same way. You kind of read against the grain. He says, oh, I don't want to have anything to do with those people. They're all over the place and they have bad ideas and bad beliefs and bad practices. So again, you brush against the grain of the discourse to see, well, there must have been a lot of it if he felt he had to defend himself against it. And then Lloyd Ridgeon again has written a very interesting essay on a 1668 work of a non-order, if you will, kind of Sufi style activity, which suggests that there was a lot going on there, which wasn't, as it were, necessarily organized in that sense, not immediately identifiable with a particular Sufi order, such as the Nurbakshis or the Zahabis or anything like that. Okay, sort of winding down here. One can accept that there's possibly some exaggeration in some of these charges that the critics of the Abu Muslim veneration and Qomi himself were leveling. But one does detect, if you step way back, a distinct anti-clerical sentiment. That's what I see as kind of the if you stand back and see the forest through the trees. So again, in terms of doctrines, you can see that they rejected Elm as the sole preserve of the ulama. They rejected the reality of hell. They supported the notions of transmigration of souls. They saw Abu Muslim as a great friend of Ahlul Bayt, and they saw Ibn Muljam as actually being directed in his role of killing Imam Ali. In terms of practices, they rejected attending the mosque. They rejected prayer. They weren't in favor of paying zakat, and they didn't undertake hajj. They favored monasticism, lots of attendance at the Khanagah, special foods, that is abhorrence of meat, and distinctive dress. And what these speak to me to say is that they were looking for some sort of personal, direct, or unmediated connection with or to the divine. And you can see that especially in some of these physical activities that get highlighted for criticism, singing, dancing, whirling, spinning, swooning, all these kinds of things. Allow, I think, a personal connection. You don't need the ulama, you don't need somebody to help you do this, to interpret what's right and wrong. If you get into these kinds of physical activities, you will attain some sort of better connection with this. You don't need Arabic to understand all these texts. You can kind of do these things on your own, as it were. And there's some parallels with these kinds of anti-clerical sentiments with antinomianism as it's being critiqued in England between 1641 and 1660, during the time that of the English Revolutionary period, when censorship was more limited than on either side of this. Christopher Hill talks a lot about these kinds of doctrines and the anti-clerical sentiments which underlie them in his volume, The World Turned Upside Down. So if we're trying to recover these voices, urban and rural, here we have some clues onto what's going on in some urban settings. Orthodoxy clearly then is under challenge in 17th century urban settings on the Iranian plateau during the time of the Safavids. One can see the power of the urban classes, especially in Isfahan and other instances. Abbas I had to change his initial Maidan expansion plans and move them someplace else because he had a lot of resistance there at the time. Sheikh Bahi, who was appointed Sheikh al-Islam by Shah Abbas I, had to give up that post. He relinquished it and was being attacked. Faisal Kashani died in 1680, whom we know for his philosophical inclinations and such, was appointed Friday prayer leader. He was forced to to give up that post as well. I've written about that. And we can see here in the essays, the anti-Abu Muslim tracts, that in fact, the admirers of Abu Muslim had the detractors on the run, stretching to Mir Lauhi being attacked in the streets and a whole bunch of other authors writing in and about anti-Sufi polemics and anti-Abu Muslim polemics, but not really wanting to identify themselves as the authors. We can see risings across the period by the Nuqtafis, by Darwish Riza in this period. And we can see that the popularity of certain Sufi orders is attested. The Nurbakhshiya, for example, the Zahabis, and other non-order kinds of activities are also in evidence in Isfahan, Shiraz, and Meshed. What about on the countryside? Well, I think the way to begin to explore this is to assume that there is on the plateau and these other areas, the same sort of unorthodox blend of Sufi Shi'i messianism that was on offer in these areas prior to the rise of the Safavids. Very millenarian, very messianic, not certainly orthodox according to the Shi'i ulama. And therefore, if you begin to, and that's where my research would head next, but in sum total, I think one can suggest at least that in the bottom half of the pyramid, that is the majority population, antinomianism may well have been the norm, the rule, and not the exception. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That was a very beautifully delivered diatribe. I don't know if we've got any questions yet. I haven't seen any. I might just start the ball rolling. I mean, well, two things struck me really. One is you said these people were writing in Persian, which of course they were. But referring to your map of linguistic ability and diversity in Iran at this period, the audience would have been very small. And in a sense, just like the chroniclers and the other elite, they were really writing for themselves, weren't they? And so what you're trying to do is see what they are writing against is what they feel. You were a little bit vague about who they were. You know, they're in favor of Abu Muslim, they're in favor of Sufism, they're in favor of blah, blah, blah. Do we have any sort of idea of a wider audience who would be listening to this, or if there'd be sort of sympathetic scholars in the country, well, not in the countryside, but in the other provincial centers who might be echoing this material to a wider audience outside the two main cities?
Yeah, I talk about that in the article on the anti-Abu Muslim stuff as well. I think that primarily what's going on is that in Persian, they're writing to other clerics, getting them in tune with the arguments against the against the veneration of Abu Muslim. I think they're writing primarily in Persian because, again, as I suggested, in terms of the development of Isfahan in particular, and in the early stages of this diatribe against Abu Muslim, again, I suggested it's mainly in Isfahan. We don't have too much evidence of the pro-Abu Muslim factions being anywhere else on the plateau based on that first essay. And again, I discussed that essay in greater detail. There. It was composed by a guy from Mashhad who went to Isfahan and saw this. He then, instead of writing, he was a friend, became a friend of Mirlauhi, but instead of writing the text there in Isfahan, he goes back to Mashhad, where he seems to have deemed it safe to write, and he writes this essay and then sends it back there to Isfahan. So he was so on the run that, in my view, he was afraid of getting any more trouble that Mirlauhi was already getting on. And he ended up then going back to Mashhad. The later two seem to have been written in Isfahan, but again, there's not so much evidence for that being a nationwide or plateau-wide discourse. But I think it's also talking to the native Tajik population, again, very tiny, you're absolutely right, very tiny in Isfahan in particular, who were in the guilds. And again, you look at these references, and again, I mentioned this in the article, to people like Mullah Sadra and others who are noting this kind of Sufi style activity as being connected with the Balzars in particular. And so that's where it mainly seems to be focused there. Again, it's more widely discussed in the article. So. But well, yes, that would be right. It is very limited. I'm not making any grand claims for that. What's interesting is over the period, you see this Sufi style discussion in terms of named orders and other sorts of diatribes, again, then also locatable by the end of the 1600s, then to other places outside Isfahan. Mashhad and Shiraz are named, and Khorasan generally are named as centers of this. But again, I would suggest that's mainly urban, until I suggest otherwise. But yes, that's right.
Andrew, we've had a couple of questions coming in. Lloyd Ridgen.
Hi, Lloyd.
Says he can't think of any Sufi texts that mention Abu Muslim as a great champion of Sufi ideas, but he says he hopes there are some. I don't know if you'd like to answer that.
Sorry, there is. I missed that.
Lloyd Ridgen has written, I can't think of any Sufi texts.
Is there any evidence of Sufis writing about this? Well, I'd look at your own article, which was very good, actually. There is some other stuff that I do discuss in the articles But you recaptured this text, 1668, I think it was, that again was citing texts back at the ulama, saying, look, we can do this hadith stuff and we can talk about this kind of stuff as well. And I came across another text as well that's also discussed in the articles, where you see riposts from, I wouldn't say they were necessarily pro-Sufi types, but they were defending themselves against these charges. And then there was a very vigorous debate that I discussed some years ago on the legitimacy of ghana, of singing, wherein you get people who are recognized clerics of the period who are saying, well, look, certain forms of ghana are okay. And I can cite you a bunch of hadiths and such about this. Hura Amali writes about this. There's an interchange going on there as well. But no, I don't think of any particular Sufi texts that mention Abu Muslim. But we're still looking, you never know. Anthony suggests, can I do this one myself, Charles?
Is that yes, okay?
Anthony Wynn says, although few copies of these texts appear to have been made, might there have been, absolutely. Yes, I certainly think that's the case. And looking at the numbers of copies is not absolute. It's just kind of interesting. And what I say is indicative, okay, that they were there. You can see if you map this, and I do this on 12 or Shiism, in my Edinburgh University Press book on 12 or Shiism, I map for the later half of the 17th century in Iran, an outpouring of manuscript copies of several, of a number of very key early Shi'i texts, again, as suggesting the expansion of interest in some of these key texts in the context of these debates, one certainly on Sufism, on Abu Muslim, but also Akhbaris and Usulis, things like Friday prayer. This generated an interest on all parts of, let's go back to the original texts and see what they can say. And again, in an earlier, in another essay, not discussed here, I talked about this debate on ghana and Sufi practice and such, as over the course of the 1600s, featuring ever greater, numerically greater references to the hadith on either side. And you can see this as you look at these texts along the way. And you can tie that in with the greater availability of some of these key Buyid period texts, in particular the four canonical collections of Shi'i hadith put together before the Seljuks showed up, and texts of Alameh Hilli and other Hillis and other figures. And again, in the appendices of the Edinburgh University Press books, you can see those numbers. Absolutely, they're not proof positive. It's just interesting that you see so few, and then all of a sudden you see an awful lot. So in some cases, you're going to notionally a handful of copies, all the way to three figures worth of copies, or high two figures worth of copies. So no, it's not proof positive. It's just kind of interesting when across the manuscript copies of these very early texts, all along the way in the late 1600s, the numbers of manuscript copies get very much higher. And if you think about it, when you look at these, the standard texts of a lot of these early Shi'i manuscripts, if you look at the manuscript copies that are used for getting these copies, an awful lot of them are from the Safavid period. So of 10, for example, there might be 7 Safavid period ones, maybe 1 undated and 2 earlier. So it does suggest, as I say, it's interesting, it's indicative, but it's not proof positive. So I see some others, but I can't see them all, Charles. So.
Yes, Andrew, there's Suzanne Babayi has written to say, would you speak about the period of Shah Sultan Hussein in this connection?
Let me see if I can in the connection of,
well, in the terms you're speaking about, for the period of Shah Sultan Hussein.
Yeah, well, I think that, again, and Atta Anzali has also done this. He has a very good article in the Zahabis, and then he has his big, thick book, too, as well. And in respect of the actual orders, I sort of think what he's beginning to say is quite interesting there, because, again, it's confirming these kinds of things. And he's also of the, he's all sort of, is he there? I don't know if he's there or not, but I'll suggest, in my opinion, he talks about this notion of Sufi decline and says, look, this doesn't really work. And he's the one on whom I depend for the Zahabi discussion in particular. And what he's arguing is that the Zahabis were alive and well, no, not necessarily in Isfahan, but certainly in other areas. And the Nurbakshis, again, seem to be the case, again, in those years, which would include the reign of Shah Sultan Hussein as well. Abu Muslim, as she will know, because she preceded me in lots of these discussions in her PhD dissertation and then in her terrific book, these kinds of things were going on in that period, but I'm trying to put them in chronology. And I think what I'm trying to suggest is that where everybody says that Sufism was gone, no, that doesn't seem to be the case. It doesn't seem to be the case as Anzali has shown for named Sufi orders, but there is some other kind of beliefs and doctrines going on here, which even if exaggerated in the film that they've been criticized, nevertheless, again, if you stand back, you see a distinct anti-clerical flavor to them. That's what I'm trying to suggest. And again, you're absolutely right, Charles. It's a limited basis, okay? So we don't really know what's going on among, say, non-Persian speakers, and we don't really know what's going on among tribes and peasants. But again, I'm trying to recover recoverable sets of voices, and here are these works which allowed me to make a start, so.
We have a question from Zeynep Tamasuki. Thank you very much for the great presentation. Do we have evidence in Mashhad and Shiraz, which non-minorities had the power to shape urban spaces and control them? And she says in the Qajar period, there is evidence, but she's right. Passionate.
I now see these, so thanks very much. I can see these now, sorry. I'm not very good with all this Zoom stuff, so I'm surprised it worked at all, really. So thank you very much for your comments. Not quite yet. You do in the Qajar period. And again, if we invert the pyramid, okay, and you extrapolate from time when we do have that evidence, then I think the evidence is out there to be discovered. I think it's sitting there. And again, one way to do this is to take the text that we do have and a la Walter Benjamin kind of read them against the grain or brush against the grain. Again, in my Shiism book on the Edinburgh University Press book, I try to do this with texts of Alameh Hilli and others, looking at those bits where Hilli and others along these centuries kind of get hot under the collar and or they recount arguments. I mean, they're writing these texts to debate with people. It's just that we don't necessarily know who brought up the original questions. But you can get a sense of the kinds of questions that are being asked all along the way. I mean, Hilli at one point is clearly upset with some of his students. And I quote him in the book as saying, you know, my students should do this. You know, they should listen quietly and attentively and not be raucous. I guess we've all had examples of that. But Hilli does that occasionally. And again, you can get this sense of anti-clerical, anti-hierarchical discussion too. So Zeynep, I think it's there. I think you just need to read this stuff and find out. And I think unlike the court, but sometimes that might be doable with the court chronicles, it's possible. Though I defer to Cholet on how you need to be very careful with these things. And the travel logs, I think, for what's really going out in the countryside, really, these are snapshots by people who didn't speak any Persian, relying on government translators, and they're moving through areas. So they're not too useful for this. I think it's the religious texts that will provide us, yes, with the key to what's going on. If we look at the arguments and then try and infer with whom they are arguing. And if we look to other centers, the late Iraj Afshar used to talk about the importance of urban history. So I think if we begin to attack Mashhad, if we begin to go into Tabriz, if we go into Shiraz and other centers, you're going to put those and the religious texts together. And yeah, in my view, it's going to be, it's findable. Maybe not by myself, but I think the stuff is out there. So there's...
Well, we have Saeed Reza Talajui. Okay, the popularity is at the level of narratives produced by the common people and some poets. Yeah. Of course, it was quite a popular text, the Abu Muslim Nama. In fact, it was illustrated as well. There are copies of it, illustrated texts.
I don't see. Oh,
and right. Lloyd popularity is more than
it could be. It's hard to say. Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, produced by the common people, if we're talking about the common people, in my definition, wouldn't necessarily have been literate in the first place. These are the avam, you know, the kind of masses. And you see the avam usually denounced for this kind of thing. But yes, you have to see about that. I have to explore it more. I'm just trying to feel the ground here with some texts that had been discussed before, but not actually looked at.
I could jump go ahead, over, Sholay.
Do the order, yeah, please.
We have hello, Sholay. Lloyd again. Why are the ulama have a hang up on Abu Muslim? Isn't that partly because it was very popular, the Abu Muslim name?
Well, but that's he true.
He became a figure that they could identify with because partly, of course, he was so involved in allegedly being a sort of Shi'i, you know, someone who got rubbed out at the beginning of the Abbasid era. I mean, he's my father, most sort of prominent of most of these figures.
Yeah, I think you have to read the stuff. I really didn't have time to give an adequate summary, but you can see what it is, again, reading back against it, why it was, I think, that the ulama, in particular Mir Lauhi and others, were upset about it. And again, for purposes of this afternoon, I'm just trying to step back and say there was a general anti-clerical sentiment here. But I think if you read my exposition of the text, you might get more of a flavor of why they were hung up on Abu Muslim in particular. What I find interesting is that, I mean, it was clearly a thing in the early 1600s. So what happened to it in the later 1600s? And usually my answer, and Catherine, I think, has talked about a little bit, that it gets, I think, in my own head right now, in October of 2020, I kind of think, well, the argument is it's been replaced by this anti-Sufi diatribe, but that's not satisfying somehow. I'm not really pleased with that explanation. But you can see similarities in the doctrines and practices which are being attacked in the anti-Abu Muslim texts with those being denounced in the anti-Sufi texts as well. So there's certainly an aspect of that, this hulu business, ghana, and all this kind of business gets transferred to the Sufi stuff too. And I think that's, again, it's an anti-hierarchical discussion. We can do this unmediated. The individual can do this in an unmediated fashion by engaging in these kinds of activities. And even if some of them are exaggerated, fair enough. And Hill makes this argument too, that even in the literature in 1640s, 50s, and so, that the diatribes against the antinomianism of England were exaggerated. Nevertheless, he also steps back and says, what you can see here is a reaction against the clerics. He talks about tithes as the among the things that the riffraff will not partake in. Absolutely no church. We don't go to church. We don't do this. We can meet up with ourselves and do this ourselves. This is the levelers and the ranters and such, whose existence, to be sure, has been questioned. But nevertheless, on the other side, it does seem as if they were there. And I would say these groups are certainly there too. It's interesting that the same kind of stuff is there. Antinomianism seems to have very similar features, even when you get into the detail. This notion that Hill brings in about inner light and such. Again, the individual can do this, doesn't need to be mediated, doesn't need to be told what to do by some educated, you know, faqih or something like that. Charles, go ahead.
Yes, well, we must, Sholay has a very nice point about the Shah Ismail histories, which were written in the 1680s or so. As you know, the late Safavid Anonymous histories of Shah Ismail, do these help understand the Safavid popular culture landscape?
Well, I sort of talk about that in my Safavid book from 2006 a little bit. Those haven't really been examined as much as one would like, but I tend to look on those very late ones. I mean, they're all later texts, as I suggest, and it seems to me that by that time we're in the process of revising history. Look, it really happened this way. And some of the things that we read about, which scholars tend to present as true, really are looking back at things, projecting back certain discourses that they want to be popular now. And that kind of goes back, I think, possibly to this notion of what's going on in the Shah Soleiman and Shah Sultan Hussein. A certain image, it wants to be projected, and therefore we're going to project that back into the origins of the Safavids. Okay. There was one, I think I talked about cannibalism or something like that, or mass numbers of Sunnis were killed. And you see that kind of surfacing later, but you don't see much of that at the time. So I think that's a credentialing, a legitimization of certain authority and power. that's being, so early Safavid history is being rewritten by people in the later Safavid period, which is, one would expect that, actually, but whether we should give credence to it as actual fact, that's another thing entirely. So.
Well, it's nice to see Catherine Babayan tuning in. I thought, hello, Catherine, you might be interested in Andrew's paper. I've jumped over Jake Benson, but just to say hello to Catherine first.
Hi, Catherine.
Clearly from the content of these Abu Muslim and Sufi rads, these were debates going on orally. A rich exchange in writing on paper gives us an indication of how vibrant the tensions were. I think that's a very good point.
That's absolutely right. I mean, if you go through Catherine will know the material as well, or certainly probably better than I. But again, I tracked it down in one of these essays and tried to count up all the various titles and cross-reference the various references to all these titles. And I come up with about 24 named essays which attacked the veneration of Abu Muslim. So clearly, yeah, there was tons of stuff going on out there. But interesting that only the tip of the iceberg survived. That's what I find kind of interesting. And I think this is partially because these folks felt on the run. So they're writing a lot because it's very popular, okay? But they are clearly on the defensive. And I think the fact that there are so few of these copies that Rezavi, the author of the first of the Abu Muslim treatise, has to go back to Mashhad. I can't stay here, I'll get attacked. So he goes back to Mashhad and he said, here's my contribution to this discussion, but I'm doing it from the safety of Khorasan because I don't want to stay around Esfahan in order to attack this and be there and to support my friend Mir Lauhi. As I recall, Catherine, I think this guy, the author spent some time in Mir Lauhi's house or something. I mean, he was a house guest for a while. And he couldn't, you know, stay around to defend his patron. I recall, I'd have to go look at the article myself and reread it. So, but I think they were on the run. And I think that's what the number of the Ruds attests to, and the lack of very many copies attests to that as well. So,
have you seen Jake Benson's comment?
Let's see this one.
About the Shah Ismail I era. Are there any attacks on what was going on?
Yes, there are. Again, in the paper, but not this afternoon, I talk about some of the attacks that were extant by Al-Karaki and others. What's interesting, in the previous century. What's interesting about those, however, is that those of which we have any record, and there weren't too many that we've got too many records of, were written in Arabic. And there, it seems to me that Karaki and others are trying to get, they're kind of writing to themselves here, even more so than I think one could argue about the Persian language decision, if you will, to write in Persian in the early 1600s. But it's there, and I do discuss it a bit in the paper. There, I think, in that paper, and also in earlier material I've written, I think it's more a case of that being more rural in nature, as would befit the nature of this Sufi-Sunni millenarian discourse on the plateau generally, that brought the Safavids, if you will, to power. Whereas by the late 1500s and early 1600s, this is being seen now on the urban setting. And it's moving into Persian as well, commensurate, as I suggest, with the growth of Isfahan as the inadverted commas, Allah yourself, Charles, designation of Isfahan as a capital, some sort of important place. I remember your article many, many years ago about maybe it was and maybe it wasn't. We need to reconfigure that. But it certainly was expanding in terms of, as I say, spiritual infrastructure and political infrastructure as well. And that brought the expansion of the bazaar and that brought a lot more Tajiks and international trade and such Persian speakers as well. Still a small number, but nevertheless discernible. And it was there that you're having this antinomian sort of behavior. Remember, there's a famous story of Shah Abbas I sending preachers and such into the bazaar to preach against this or that or whatever it is. So they would have known what was going on. Again, Mir Damad and Sheikh Bahai, who were court appointees, of course, Sheikh Bahai had to give that up under popular pressure, nevertheless, were part of that attack on this kind of popularity and such. And again, this is a challenge to the clerical hierarchy. Who interprets salvation? Or if you can do it yourself, gee, you don't need to pay your taxes. You don't need to undertake all these kinds of activities. You can go to the shrine, the Chanukah, or you can forswear something for 40 days and achieve it, you know, in these kinds of aesthetic, individual personal affections. And you can judge. You don't have to have somebody else telling you the hows and the whys and maybe engaging in some sort of funny language stuff in Arabic and them sort of, well, I know that Arabic stuff and you don't know it. You can see it in these early treatises, for example, in the anti-Muslim, anti-Abu Muslim stuff, that these guys are very fun. Oh, I can see, I can do this Arabic. I'm going to quote you this text in Arabic. You don't know Arabic. I know Arabic. So who are you going to believe? Well, you're going to have to believe me because I'm the educated scholar, not these riffraff who don't, you know, speak any Arabic. They don't know the real stuff. And of course, this is being rejected. This clerical authority is being said, no, we can do this ourselves. We don't need you to tell us what to do. And by the way, we don't need to pay you our religious taxes. We can do with them what we wish.
This is a very interesting point about anti-clericalism generally, because, I mean, we all have the impression that, I mean, until relatively recently, even in Christianity or in the West, that, you know, it's an element of superstition. I mean, you're worried about the future and the afterlife and, you know, whether you're going to go to hell or not. And the only guys who are going to give you the answer, either going to be the clerics or they're going to be the Sufis. And it you know, the so-called popular religion is often more popular than the formal one. I mean, I would call myself a Christian.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think
if you, Christian theology in my brain.
Yeah, I think if you delve into this stuff, you're going to find, especially among the majority, that is the tribal in this suburban, sorry, the countryside, you know, outside the cities, you're going to find you're going to have more of that, okay? Because I don't see all that many clerics who are going out into the middle of nowhere to preach 12-er Shiism. And if in the middle of nowhere, that's where the most people are, I don't find them going there in this period. I mean, there wasn't any Wi-Fi. You're just not going to go place where there's no Wi-Fi. Why would you want to do that? You know, you got to have your this and your that. So you're going to stay where you are comfortable and where your authority is recognized and patronized, certainly by the court. But if the majority of the population is out there in what the Americans occasionally refer to as the boondocks, I bet they don't know very much about this. They don't speak the language, and they will have their own understandings of how you attain salvation. Salvation is important. But, you know, we have other sources of authority here. You can see this if you look at medicine in this period as well, that in the popular level, medicine is a blend of magic, and it's a blend of prophetic medicine, and it's a blend of the Galenic as well. And you can see this on offer in texts that I've looked at throughout the history of Islamic medicine generally, but as well in the Safavid period as well. You can clearly see these are all on offer. And again, one would surmise that out in the middle of nowhere where most people lived, they're kind of blending these things. It's very, I would say, pragmatic and practical, whatever works. So I'll try a prayer, I'll try some of this mixture, which I think one of the imams said might be efficacious. And of course, there's the evil eye as well. And so I kind of have to, you know, hedge my bets here. And this was seen as normal and natural, whereas the Orthodox clergy said, absolutely not. This is the way that this needs to be done. And they would have been in the minority.
I'm slightly relying on Bluffer's Guide to Safavid History and stepping outside my, you know, my area of comfort. But I thought one of the features that we all take as more or less axiomatic is the rise of the Imamzadeh as a sort of popular local, barely an institution, but sort of replacing Sufi shrines in a way. And this being a sign really that the clerics were sort of winning, or at least the imami argument was sort of winning over the rough and ready holy man argument. I mean, this may be complete nonsense, of course, but in which case generations of my students have been fed the wrong story.
Well, I think that the Imamzadehs and these little local shrines, again, if you look in the Safavid period, some of these religious infrastructures were built by local merchants and such, and they became taken over and used for their own purposes by the popular classes in the urban areas that we know anything about, again, very limited, okay? And so it may have been built with a particular intention, but again, it would have been abstracted by local people into something else. Catherine will know this one better than I, but what wasn't there, one of the things that really agitated Mir Lauhi was, who was an opponent of again, Abu Muslim and such, but also was an opponent of Muhammad Taqi Majlisi, the father of Muhammad Baqir, was that when Muhammad Taqi's coffin was carried around in the streets, people attacked it. They wanted bits of it, okay, as sort of amulets or something like this. And so again, there's this popular practice stuff. And Taqi Majlisi, his legacy and his contributions even at the time are debated. Was he pro-Sufi? Was he a Sufi himself? These kinds of things. And one looks at the texts and reads them in various ways. But if we stop back and we accept Mir Lauhi as having said that, it's quite an extraordinary thing. So one accepts there's something to it. The popular veneration of Taqi Majlisi sounds interesting because I don't know that Taqi Majlisi would have necessarily favored some of these problematic doctrines and practices. And yet people put on to him his understanding of this and his acceptance of this. And I would say it'd be the same with these kinds of buildings. You can build the thing, but how in a generation or so it gets used and interpreted is an entirely different thing. And you kind of have to go on a piecemeal basis, one-to-one, and see how it was actually used. So trace the history of a couple of these over a period and see how it was reused, as it were, over a couple of generations. And I think you can see that in some of the buildings, the religious buildings that were built in Isfahan in this period. They clearly had one intention, but it does seem as if people went and did of it as they wanted. I think it was out there to say, you know, Ahlul Bayt and the Imams and the Safavids and such, but whether the popular classes got and accepted that message needs to be examined.
Well, we have, Saeed Reza Talajui sent a link to a nice article by Zabihullah Safar.
I don't see that. If he could send me that link, I would very much appreciate it.
Yeah, I also asked him to do the same because I couldn't download it.
exactly right. Yep.
And then Lloyd is back again.
Hi, Lloyd.
Lloyd wants to know if antinomianism of the period contributed to the emergence of a Sunni rationalism at the expense of the Akbaris.
Well, I think so. I think especially if you recontextualize the kinds of debates, put it back into the terrain of the debates that are going on in this period. So over Friday prayer, for example, over Sufism, over singing and Akbaris and Usulis. I used to think, however, and I used to think that there was a fine line between these Akbaris and Usulis, and now I'm kind of coming down along the way that there were these moderate Akbaris who were really just as Usuli as anything else when it came to issues of clerical hierarchy. So Tahir Homi was purportedly an Akbari, but as I've argued elsewhere, really, when you look at people like him and Faiza Kashani, who's also supposedly an Akbari, look, they were into this clerical hierarchy. So the notion of ijtihad may have been, as it were, a step too far, but you still have to listen to what I have to say. Okay, and if that's an aspect of Usulism, okay, then that was common to a number of so-called Akbaris, moderate Akbaris, if you will. But there were all these debates. It was very vibrant kind of time, philosophy and Sufism and Abu Muslim and singing and who knows what going on, of which we have a, you know, just some, we hit really the tip of the iceberg. And in the midst of this, as part of and contributing to these debates are the, if you will, the rediscovery of key early Shi'i texts, more manuscript copies available. Baqir Majlisi himself sending people out to try and find the famous fifth book by Ibn Babawayh, Medina al-Elm, which he never discovered, but it seems Sheikh Baha'i's dad had a copy of that and then it went disappeared. Trying to find these texts as a means at least of trying to find evidence for their points of view at the time. And again, if you look at the anti-singing debate that I've discussed in other articles, you can see an exponential increase in the citation of hadiths from the early 1600s, mid 1600s when this Ghana stuff got started, to the later 1600s. It's just just lots more. And they're going back to the coffee and they're citing it by name. And here it is, I've got these texts. And those texts don't figure, those Hadith texts and other texts of previous Shi'i notables don't figure so much in the early 1600s. And again, if you look at the data, as it will, on extant manuscript copies, it's indicative. It kind of supports that later on in the period, you've got a lot more copies from which to work. Both sides, everybody's using this stuff. And again, in the in some of these other articles, the text of the article talks about the if you will, the pro-Sufi or the pro-Ghana people using these texts as well to know, no, Ghana is okay. It's just in certain contexts, you can't do it.
We've got another question here, Maxim Alontsev. Maybe this should be our last one. We've been going on slightly over an hour now. Can you see this? It's actually an interesting point because the chronicles, of course, do refer to rebellions and revolts and things. I haven't really looked into this, but somebody undoubtedly has. And are they branded as sort of heretics or antinomian, or are they just sort of political dissenters, as it were? I don't know if you've looked into this at all.
I've not traced that, and that's I really should go look at that. When I came into the Safavids, as it were, I came in from the religious texts point of view. So that's the things in which I'm kind of more interested. And for my next kind of big project, I'm actually forswearing the Safavids and going back to some earlier stuff. So I came in in that angle. But you're absolutely right. One should go back. But I think when you do look at these court chronicles, I think you have to be very mindful of what Cholet teaches us. You need to recontextualize this, as you do with Tahir Homi. I'm not saying you don't need to be careful. I'm just saying, again, looking at these things and saying, well, this is what happened. Well, it's not exactly what happened. Something was going on there. And how can we infer from what's being attacked, again, indirectly, and again, I use the word infer, suggest, bespeak, attest, but not prove, because I don't necessarily think you can prove what was going on there. And plainly, there's lots and lots going on there. And you'd want to unpack those, and then you'd want to look again, try to resituate them in certain settings. Is it more rural? Is it more urban? There are people who've written about rebellions, elsewhere in the country, and somehow that stuff needs to be assimilated, which will not be done by me. But meanwhile, there are these examples of the, if you will, the non-absolute authority of the Safavid rulers. So this is why I shy away from using words like state and such. And I prefer using words like constituencies. And it's a takeoff from some of the work that was being done on the Qajars. A book came out about the same time that I came out with my Safavid book, The Qajar Pact, written by Charles, help me out. I'm getting old.
Sorry, I missed the first part of your speech.
Who wrote the book called The Qajar Pact?
Oh.
Sorry to put you on the spot. But
I haven't read that, actually. Sorry.
Well, anyway, whoever that was, I really apologize because I should know this kind of stuff, but I'm just getting old and gray, as you can see. Anyway, the Qajar Pact notion was, and Abrahamian talks about that too in his book, The History of Modern Iran, talks about how you negotiate rule in Iran. Okay. And I think that's what you did in the Safavid period. You negotiated, the court negotiated rule. Okay. And there were certain, if you will, lines in the sand, red lines, one of which was you couldn't challenge the authority of the ruling Shah. But anything short of that, you could have a lot of vigorous debate, no problem. And, the Shahs lost Sheikh Bahai and Faiz Kashani had to quit because of popular pressure. So they put in different people to try and work on these things and push the message forward. But again, across the country is a lot more decentralized. There wasn't a standing army necessarily to send out there to crush all these rebellions. So you kind of, went with the flow insofar as was possible at the court level, not an absolutist state in any manner, shape or form. Hence, I use words like polity or project or something like that, rather than talk about the Safavid state, because it connotes this notion of absolute authority, which I just don't think was the case. So if that's true, then the diversity is there, and we just need to assume it, again, turn the whole model on its head and assume diversity, and then let's go out and search for it.
I was just wondering if any of the political, or you know, the sort of revolt that gets into the Chronicles, whatever messianic.
Vanessa Martin, sorry, I apologize. Five people have said this. Thank you all very much. I appreciate that. Look at the gray hair. That's it. Yeah. Thank you all. Go ahead, Charles.
I was going to say, I remember in the Mongol period, the Ilkhanid Chronicles, there are one or two revolts that are described as people pretending they were the Messiah. And I'm just wondering, I can't remember in the Safavid Chronicles if there's anything like that.
Yeah,
I don't remember Dervish Reza. I know Catherine Babayan's written that,
yeah.
Whether he was trying to be a Messiah, I can't remember, but that would fit in with an extreme case, I suppose, of what you're talking about.
And what's also interesting about the Nuktavis, and again, Catherine has talked about this too, so is that with the Nuktavi rebellions and such, what there is, interestingly, is a confluence of interests between certain prominent tribal figures and urban bazaari types across several cities. So when the Nuktavis had their thing in the late 1500s, early 1600s, Catherine will know better than I, but it's all in the Safavid book and elsewhere, you can see that these groups are working together. So when heads are lopped off, and that's a head loppable off offense to try and replace the Shah, you can't do that. That's past the line. But you nevertheless see these alliances of urban and tribal elites. And if we are to say that the tribal chief is to some extent representative of his followers, and that may not be a safe assumption, but we tend to do that. As the tribal chief says, everybody does this. I'm not so sure that's true, but that's what we tend to assume. Then it would, if we assume that, would mean that some of the tribes people themselves then were buying into this kind of messianism that's around among the Nuktavis and Darvish Reza and other kinds of people. I think Darvish Reza is one, or there's another one around that time period. They lopped off his head and then he popped up again someplace else. So this wasn't, unheard of. And this, I would say, was probably more the norm. You see, this is what I'm trying to say, inverting the pyramids, probably more the norm than the exception. And if that's true, then we really need to turn our understanding of what's going on in the Safavid period kind of on its head, along with inverting the pyramid of society and populations.
Of course, I now realize I have Vanessa Martin's book on the Qajar Pact, but I think, the gray hair and the senility is sort of setting in.
I think I have more gray hair than yours, yeah.
The sun never sets in Edinburgh.
No, it never does. It's always like this. It's always warm and sunny.
And can see that it's taking a very long time to go down behind King Arthur's seat. But I think that we've run out of questions and possibly we've exhausted ourselves with this. Thank you very much, Andrew, for a very stimulating talk. And you can see from the level of interest and the questions and the subsequent discussion that it's been extremely much enjoyed. So thank you very much for that. And thank you everybody for listening.
Much appreciated, Charles, and thank you to everybody who asked questions, and to Louise and Sylvia and yourself at BIPS for facilitating this. Otherwise, I would have been at sixes and sevens trying to do this myself. So,
excellent. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to log off now, and I suggest everyone else does as well. Thank you, Andrew, and thank you everybody.
Thank you.